Let me repeat the provocative sentence with which I opened the program. The first brave Australian patriots were Aboriginal, and you can hear a frisson as listeners consider the implications of that. Thus saith Henry Reynolds. Henry's written a new one, Forgotten War, in which he argues that as we increasingly militarise our history through the growing commemorations of the Anzac, and at the same time we work towards reconciliation between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians, it is more imperative than ever that those original conflicts between them and us be properly acknowledged. Now, this wasn't the first time Henry and I had discussed the topic, and it's come up on the program frequently, so why is Henry putting this issue front and centre now?
Well, two things, Philip. One is there has been a great deal of new work on frontier conflict that I think is not widely known. But secondly, as you remarked, there has been this extraordinary increase in the emphasis on the importance of war, and that this is not going to go away, it's going to increase, there's massive expenditure, and we will celebrate and commemorate war right up till 2018.
But we both would acknowledge that there's a political motivation in this, and that it often places a camouflage, now there's a good military term, over inept political decisions.
Oh, absolutely, and we don't really consider what the war was about, whether it was worth Australia being in it, was the loss of life worthwhile, did we achieve anything? All of these questions are left aside while we celebrate sacrifice and heroism. Now, that's quite new in a way. I mean, of course, Anzac Day was always celebrated when I was growing up, but the enormous expansion of the commemoration of war is quite extraordinary. Now, at the same time, we know that there was continuing conflict within Australia, all around the frontiers, as settlers moved into new country, as they would have called it. And I don't think we can keep the two apart. We can't continually talk about the importance of war while neglecting the war within Australia.
One of the reasons that it has to be discussed is because people are now learning through programs like First Footprints on the ABC that Aboriginal people way back when were magnificently strong and fit looking. They were, you know, they were heroic in appearance, and we've tended to forget that.
That's right. Probably with much better diets than most Europeans of the period, and a very physical life from the consequence of the food quest and constant movement, and indeed those pictures that we have of people, you know, before contact. Not only are the adults healthy, but of course there are many healthy children.
Yeah, and it is, I think, a significant factor in almost an aesthetic response to the idea of Aboriginality. Now, when you talk about proper acknowledgement, do you mean monuments? There are some sites around the place. I'm thinking of the Mile Creek Massacre.
Yes, there are a few, but mainly been done by private individuals. There's virtually no public recognition, and certainly nothing approaching the way in which we have commemorated the First and Second World Wars, but even the Boer War has monuments all over the place.
Well, you've calculated there are 4,000 or 5,000 war memorials for those who didn't return from overseas engagements. Is the Australian War Memorial in Canberra guilty of this omission?
Oh, absolutely, and I think, you know, people who are much closer to the memorial have said this. I mean, Peter Stanley in particular has constantly talked about this and the need for the war memorial to come to terms with Australia's own internal wars, and many other people have spoken about this. So the war memorial has clearly got a case to answer, But of course, whether the War Memorial is ultimately the best place to deal with this is something that needs to be seriously discussed. But for the War Memorial to continue to celebrate even events like the Sudan Campaign in 1885 and the Boxer Rebellion in 1902, and to put up the names of those who died almost always from disease as being part of the great pantheon of national heroes, and not deal with the dramatic consequences of frontier warfare.
Would you say there's more acceptance now that another founding myth, to go with Terra Nullius, that there was little or no resistance from Aboriginal people, has finally been overturned?
I think that's right. I think the amount of... Well, firstly, this was never the view of people in the 19th century. Secondly, the amount of evidence in the libraries and the archives around Australia is just overwhelming. And thirdly, a lot of work has been done, new work, that has simply repeated the story of conflict almost everywhere for 140 years.
Coming back to this question of physicality, I like the way you cite Edward Eyre, 19th century explorer, writing about Indigenous people's courage. I have seen many instances of an open, manly, intrepidity of manner and bearing, and a proud, unquailing glance of eye, which instinctively stamped upon my mind the conviction that the individuals before me were very brave men. Now, okay, that can be proudly said, but part of the problem is the definition of war, isn't it? There weren't the full-scale European-style battles here, were there?
No, absolutely not. But there were many, many people in the 19th century who recognised it as war and described it as such, and many of them were military officers. So it's not a new idea that war is the term that is used. It was used constantly.
Did these military officers you're talking about ever acknowledge the legitimacy of the Aboriginal response?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There were people who, from the very start, said these people are resisting in the way that they are able our intrusion into their country. And the more sympathetic ones saw them as patriots, defending their country in ways that in European society would be regarded as heroic.
You talk about things Aboriginal leaders said in recently learned English. While raiding a farm in Tasmania, the Aborigine shouted, "Go away, you white buggers. What business have you here?" I hope that's not apocryphal.
Well, it's certainly reported by the person whose farm was being attacked. Now, whether they have the exact words is of course, something we can never be certain about, but that is indeed as it was recorded.
A South Australian settler is confronted by an angry man who declares, "Damn your eyes, go to England, this is my land." In the Northern Territory, a station manager is told, "White fella stop here too long with him bullocking. Now time white fella take him bullocky and clear out. This fellow country, him black fellow country." I like the sense of immediacy that these quotations give.
Oh yes, I think that's right. And there are enough of them to get that sense that clearly the Aborigines learnt English, forms of English, fairly quickly. I mean, far more rapidly than any European learnt Aboriginal languages until we have, you know, modern linguists. And they indeed learnt enough to make their feelings felt, and they often told the Europeans, particularly when it wasn't clear to people that the Europeans had come to stay, because Europeans often passed through their country. And they couldn't be sure that the people who arrived to settle the land were actually intending to stay forever and to regard the land as theirs. Now, by that time, the Aborigines, in various ways, both by physical resistance, by trying to express their feelings, and also undoubtedly by using sorcery to try and get rid of these interlopers.
Tell the listener about Tongalongata and Monpeliata. I hope I'm pronouncing that roughly correctly, well, who were leaders of the most intrepid war bands.
Yes, well, the groups of Aborigines in central Tasmania, known these days as the Big River and Oyster Bay tribe, and that is the way Europeans knew them in the colonial period. Now, these were the people whose country was taken by the settlers, because they in a way, they cut the country of those people in half, because this was the open grasslands of the Tasmanian Midlands that were perfect for sheep and cattle. Now, these bands in 5 years carried out campaigns against the settlers, undoubtedly the most effective resistance in anywhere in Australia. This is partly due to the terrain itself. It's partly due to the nature of the European society at that time in that place. But they were undoubtedly an extraordinarily successful, war parties. And
how would you measure the success?
Well, by the number of settlers they killed, as many as 200. But the success was obvious by the enormous effort that the colonial government went to in order to try and sweep them away from the settlers. That is the Great Black Line, when 2,000 men, armed men, marched across the territory of these people, endeavouring to push them south into the peninsulas in the far southeast. Now, that was the biggest military operation in colonial Australia, and it was aimed specifically at those people because their resistance was so effective.
What was the outcome? Remind the listener about the...
Well, the outcome was that they stumbled across this incredibly rugged country in very, very bad weather for 5 or 6 weeks, and they almost had no success whatsoever. But it's partly because they greatly overestimated the number of people that they were trying to catch. By then, there was only maybe 100 or so, whereas they thought there were thousands, simply by the ubiquity of the resistance and the speed with which these war bands moved.
Well, you're talking about what I guess a few weeks ago would have described as classic guerrilla warfare.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is how it was described, because the term guerrilla, of course, came out of the Peninsular War against Napoleon by the Spaniards, thus by the Spanish peasantry. And this is where the word came from. So many of the military officers in Tasmania had been in the peninsula. And so not only did they begin to use the word guerrilla, but they knew exactly what it was. And that is the way they described it.
As you point out, these two young black Tasmanians had been white Australian soldiers, they'd be recognised as amongst the most heroic warriors in our history, and students would learn about them and they'd be very well known, but I guess they're not taught in schools.
No, they'd be totally unknown, even though we do know something about them, and we've even got a beautiful little pencil portrait of Tonga Longata by Thomas Bock. So they are people we can know. They aren't just nameless Aborigines. We know something about them, and we can, to a very large extent, outline the extraordinary effectiveness of their resistance. And they fought the Europeans until there were only 27 of them left. That was the band that met George Augustus Robinson and eventually agreed to come to terms.
Hello now, RN Summer, historian Henry Reynolds and I discussing Australia's Forgotten War in an interview first broadcast in July last year. Well, let's go back to what we were discussing earlier, and that is the increased celebration and militarisation, rather, of our history. Quote, the soldier, not the statesman, has become the paragon of national achievement. When do you identify this, shall we say, this surge? There's another interesting military term. When do you believe the surge began?
Well, I think it's probably the last 10 years in particular. It has continued to gather momentum. There has been a continued investment in this by government through the War Memorial and the Department of Veterans Affairs that increasingly has seen its role as being an active player in the interpretation of history. And I think it has gradually increased in importance, and it is going to continue in that way.
Continue, understated by a few orders of magnitude. We're heading towards the 2015 centenary of Gallipoli.
Yes,
so it will become deafening.
The extraordinary situation we have is that the most important people in our history appear to be the soldiers, you know, service people, men and women. Brendan Nelson, who is currently now the head chairman of the board of the War Memorial, has described the War Memorial as the soul of Australia. So that all of those achievements, all of those civic achievements in our political and social life, are overshadowed by the sacrifice of service men and women overseas. To such an extent, it's as though Australia is a very strange place, and the most important events in our history didn't happen within Australia.
Brendan Nelson isn't a bad bloke, and I'm sure if he was listening to this discussion, and perhaps we should make sure that he does, he would find what you're saying persuasive. Is there something within the founding document of the War Memorial that precludes the inclusion of the Aboriginal warrior? Or would it, you know, does it require a complete rethink and a change of its constitution?
No, as I understand it, the legal advice that the War Memorial has, that it is quite able to deal with the conflict within Australia. And the critical point, there are two points, I think, that must be emphasised. One is that this was the most important war in Australia's history because it was about Australia. It was about the control of a continent and the ownership, the sovereignty of a whole continent. Now, that is an event of global importance, the most important thing that has happened in Australia in 200 years.
Okay, we're talking about wars, but let's remember another war which has been bitterly fought for decades and shows little sign of going away, and that's the history wars. On the other side of this argument, and we won't name names, there are historians who talk about black armband history. They don't like the narrative of dispossession of Indigenous people, and for that reason they won't like this.
No, I suspect that's probably the case, Philip. But I think, two things. One, I think the work that's been done since the history wars has overwhelmingly confirmed the view about the continuity of conflict. And secondly, the question, as I say, of militarisation just means that it is something that is now more important to deal with than it was even 10, 15 years ago.
Why?
Because if war is to be central to the national experience, we can't simply say, your war is not important to us, whereas our war is. And the critical question is, are the Aboriginal, are the Indigenous people of Australia our countrymen, or are they not? Now, that's one thing the Conservatives emphasise. They say, yes, of course, we're one people. Any talk about sovereignty, any talk about self-determination, they totally reject. They say, no, we are one people. Now, if we are one people, these people are our countrymen, and we have to treat them in the same way as we treat white soldiers who died overseas.
So this long-ago past is still fundamental to reconciliation.
Absolutely. But, I mean, you know, if you see Coniston in 1928 as the last of the officially endorsed massacres, it isn't that far away.
There's on page 237, you write, and with clear anger, white Australia said to Indigenous Australia, we want to be reconciled, but don't mention the war, and don't expect us to honour your countrymen and women who died while resisting our invasion. The other point that you make is this new military history is pushing other narratives aside, isn't it? The history that gave Bush workers preeminence, the 20th century story of unions and the Labour Party, pushed aside by the sound of marching boots.
Absolutely. I mean, it also pushes aside the extraordinary achievements of Australia in its social development and its politics. I mean, at the end of the 19th century, it was one of the most progressive democratic societies in the world. This was an extraordinary achievement. And it's as though these achievements have been totally overshadowed by the achievements of people going to war.
Who's listening to you? Apart from the listeners to Late Night Live. In other words, are you getting traction?
Well, whether I will get traction depends, I suppose, on how the book's received, and you can never be sure about that. It might sink without trace, it might be taken up, it might spread by word of mouth. Who knows? It's impossible to know, and whether it'll lead to any change in our attitude to frontier conflict, to Australia's own domestic war, is anyone's guess.
Well, here we are, you and I, two old white fellas discussing it. What about Aboriginal Australia? Are they behind you?
Well, I haven't talked about this for a long time. I mean, in the past, certainly there have been people who have come up to me and said, you know, what you've done has been very important to us. I would hope so, and I'd be surprised indeed if they don't appreciate that while their struggle, their heroic struggle in many cases, their patriotism is simply dismissed, they are simply not being treated as equal citizens of modern Australia.
You know, I was talking to Dennis Altman in the previous story about the high incidence of suicide among young gay men, and he put it out, women in Australia, because they're marginalised, because they feel alone and insecure. We know that young people of any and every culture need heroes. They need people to look up to. Young Aboriginals need Aboriginal heroes to look up to, don't they?
I think that's right. I think that's a perfectly normal human characteristic. And I think there's a tremendous story to tell of people who suffered so much, who continued often to resist to the very last moment, to endeavour to retain control of their homeland.
Historian Henry Reynolds, Forgotten War, published by New South Books. Next on LNL this summer, my unforgettable discussion with filmmaker Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick about their book and DVD series, The Untold History of the United States.